A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey everyone, how you going? It's Nelly here. Happy New Year to you. Don't know where that came from. Hey, we at the Dear Nelly team hope 2024 is full of love and adventure and rest and all the things, whatever that looks like for you. And thank you again for your continued support for this funny little podcast. Now, we've got some very exciting news. We have another live show coming up. This one is on Thursday, the 8th of February at the Malthouse Outdoors at the iconic Malthouse Theatre in Melbourne as part of their annual podcast season where they showcase the best podcasts around. I am thrilled to confirm that the lineup includes me, obviously, hosting. We also have comedian, author and broadcaster Sammy Shah. Jesus, he's funny. He's so great on radio. He's so great at all the things. Some of you may know him from The Australian Story on ABC, which featured the incredible tale of him and his now wife, academic Kylie Moore Gilbert, who was sentenced to 10 years in an Iranian prison, but thankfully made it home. What a love story. We also have comedian and Dear Nelly favourite, the incomparable Kirsty Wiebeck, who also happens to be one of my strawberriest of strawberry friends, and I know you all adore her. And last but not least, oh my God, we have comedian and actor Lizzie Hu. Lizzie bloody Hu. She's on all the comedy specials, on all the streaming services, and no doubt she's one of the hottest bloody comedians going around. Now, I mean hot as in popular, but you know, you go with whatever. So look, I urge you to get in and book tickets via the Malthouse website or my website at nellythomas.com, and of course there are links in the show notes. Couple of other quick reminders, keep your calls coming. If you can, join Patreon or Acast Plus for $5.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
$5 a month for bonus episodes and other rewards. This year, paid subscribers will get live Zoom events with me throughout the year where we can do Q&As and interact. Now, this podcast was recorded in the council area known as Darabin in Melbourne. I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land, the Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation, and pay my respects to their elders past, present and emerging. Last but not least, some things don't change, Moles. This is a sex, dating and relationships podcast for adults. If you don't like swearing, it's really going to give you the shit, so off you fuck.
Dear Nelly, I could use some advice, dear Nelly. Yeah, some help would be nice, dear Nelly. I'm eager to hear your point of view, dear Nelly. There's a lot to explore, dear Nelly. When you're 40 or more, dear Nelly. So I'm hoping we can talk it through. Fabulous guest, dear. you tell me what you think I should do?
Welcome to Dear Nelly, Sex, Relationships and Dating from the Other Side of 40. And we are joined today by a very special guest, Kwai Ling, academic. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Nelly. I'm really happy to be here.
Now, Ealing, tell me, how would you, I've introduced you as an academic, because that's the context in which I know you, but is that how you would introduce yourself?
I would introduce myself as a Singaporean of Chinese, Hokkien, Indonesia, Peranakan heritage. Mm-hmm. My grandparents, they migrated from China, Fujian province, and my maternal grandmother migrated from Indonesian Palembang as a marriage migrant. Mm. So I have really strong Chinese and Indonesian heritage that I am really proud of. And also, it's just a strong part of my sense of self. And I just love the food.
Of course. Who doesn't love the food? Can I ask you, first of all, what may be a silly question, but I think it's important to ask, what is a marriage migrant?
Well, so my maternal grandfather was a seaman. So he was on his way he was working on a ship, and the ship docked at Palembang in Indonesia. And then they met. Yeah, they were introduced. It was an arranged marriage. And my grandfather decided to settle there for a while. He found odd jobs, and they started a family. But he soon contracted a disease that required him to return to Singapore to seek medical treatment. And that's how my grandmother then moved with him to Singapore. And so marriage migrants, you migrate from your home country to another country because of marriage. And that's what we are also witnessing as a global trend across the world now.
So it's quite literal. It is you are migrating because of marriage.
Yes, precisely.
Yeah. Yeah. And you and I, just for context, we both spoke at an event in Sydney together called Queer Stories, and you were, and I've said this to you already, so I hope it's not offensive, but I was so pleasantly surprised at how funny you were, right? So I've been around academics a lot. I was almost one myself. You're not known for your humor, Ealing, but you were so funny. I want to get to your relationship history, but I want to know where that humor comes from.
I don't think I developed it's not a craft. Because that's not my day job. My day job is to be a researcher, to be a teacher, to work in a university. It is really just my coping mechanism.
Yes.
When you have gone through shit and
gone
through so much, and after a while, after the trauma, there's nothing else to do but just laugh and think about it. It is quite hilarious. But I think that using dark humor is also helpful to just get the message across. You make people laugh, but then as they are laughing, they can't help to ponder or contemplate upon their own laughter. Like, why am I even laughing? It's not even funny when you think about it, but people are laughing because it just sounds so absurd, right?
Yeah.
So it's a different kind of humor, and I don't think that I deliberately work on it. I was just telling my story at Queer Stories, and I think people just probably find it relatable.
Oh, 100% relatable. But they can be relatable without laughter. I think and you may have done this unconsciously, but I think that humor is very disarming. So people sometimes find it strange, the kinds of spaces that I come from and work in, whether it's family violence or child protection or homelessness or even academia, all those kinds of things. Like, how can you bring humor to those? It's exactly for the reason that you said, because these are really heavy things and you can't sit in shit 24/7, no matter how committed you are to social justice and to the world changing and to things improving. It is not fair, even on a base level, to that workforce to ask them to sit in that trauma all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can bring some kind of levity to one of their events, I feel that is, and I mean this sincerely, that is part of my activism, the ability to do that.
Yeah, I think it's. I think I, yeah, I really agree with you because I think also that the crowd at Queer Stories was mostly white, and I love that you talk about how humor can be disarming.
Yes.
My whole story was about racism and queer phobia, the intersection of both, and heteronormativity as well. And when you make them laugh, I think that the message sent across to them, conveyed to them, was a lot more impactful.
Oh, yes.
They're laughing. There's also it is also it sends a message to your whole body as they are
Yes.
moving, as they are listening.
Yes.
And I think that form of activism is really powerful, getting people to contemplate on social issues and social inequalities through laughter.
It
And
stays with you, Eling. I think that's the thing.
yeah.
Like, I have quoted from your speech multiple times to people, and I think if I'm honest, like, it's not that I haven't heard a story like yours before, but I think the humor and the levity, I mean, it was beautifully written as well, but the humor makes a big difference. Maybe that's just my brain, but it was much more memorable for me because I think it made, as you said, it made a bodily connection where you kind of go, it's almost that gasp of, oh, did that really happened? And of course I know it happened, and I know it's still happening, but it's that kind of thing where it lands differently when it's almost like your chest is open when you're laughing,
And I think the audience were laughing. It struck a chord with them. The audience was laughing because they were laughing at how ridiculous the situation was.
Correct.
And I think that is more important than the actual, the
It
comic
is.
of how it was delivered.
Yes, and not laughing at you, laughing at the absurdity of the situation and the injustice. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Now, take me back to little Ealing. So we are, what are we? 14, 15, 16. We're in high school. I think you're still in Singapore at that point. Are you dating? Are you wanting to date? What's the situation?
I think like any other young teenager, you are in that fantasy land where hormones are raging,
Yeah.
through puberty, and you dream of a nice happy ending,
Yeah.
romance, and you watch a lot of Hollywood movies and
Yeah.
Hollywood shows, and you're so influenced by what you watch. I was really innocent and I was dreaming about love, and I was hoping to anchor myself in a family and do the usual thing to be a wife, to be a mother, and that was all the fantasy that came with being at that age. So that
So
was
can I ask, Ealing, so in your teens, is that fantasy, and we all do that, right? We've all got a completely different perception of love and relationships, I think, at that age compared to that age we are at now. Did that image look like heteronormative? I'll be a wife, I'll have a husband, I'll have children, we'll stay together forever, we'll have a nice sofa, like what did it look like?
it was definitely heteronormative. I mean,
Yeah.
that was the kind of image that completely overwhelm and completely just populate your every ounce of your imagination. And growing up in Singapore is a fiercely heteronormative society. There was not much imagination about alternative family arrangements or multiple family arrangements, even till today, right? So then in the 80s and 90s, it was even a stronger message that you have to build strong families, and that really comprise heterosexual couple, legally married couple with children, and every aspect of the society really support that as well. There were so many incentives and rewards that's thrown onto this red carpet, and I wanted to be on the red carpet. I
Of
wanted
course.
to have the social status of
Yeah.
someone's wife, and
Yeah.
to have children. It really elevate your social status, and of course it comes with a lot of economic rewards as well. So that was definitely super heteronormative. I
Can
was
I just say, Iling, sometimes we talk about that stuff with a bit of embarrassment or even at its most extreme at shame, with shame. But I think it's actually a really important admission. Like being there's context in which being someone's wife, and in this case, we're saying a man's wife, comes with significant cultural capital, comes with rewards from family, and comes with economic security. So those things are real. And it's no surprise that 15, 16-year-old Ealing would be going, well, I want access to that. Why wouldn't you want access to that? And particularly, and correct me if I'm wrong, if you didn't know any queer people, if you didn't know any divorced people, if you didn't know any single women in their 40s and 50s, what other model did you have?
Exactly, there wasn't any role model.
Yeah.
And not just that, there were punitive measures put in place. So it's completely structural as well, that it, not only the incentives were there deliberately to encourage a certain kind of family model, but there were also punitive measures put in place to punish those who dared to stray away.
Yes.
Right. So there was a lot of moralizing against divorced people, or unwed mothers, or queer people, even till today. Right. So there are many punishments. Not that it's unique in Singapore, but also, in Australia, even though that multiple family arrangements could be celebrated and supported, but you will know that in current white Australian society is still highly heteronormative, and there's still so much capital attached to being straight and legally married with kids.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think when we're talking about your upbringing, it's absolutely not a case of, oh, bad in Singapore, good in Australia. Because for different reasons, but with the same outcome, I would say in the environment that I grew up, it was the same. I mean, there was probably slightly more access. Like I did know people who'd been divorced, but they were certainly talked about like this. Okay, so they weren't necessarily outcast, but I knew as a child that it was not a good thing. You know, and obviously from this age, I have a completely different perspective. So when were you dating boys? Like what did you try in that path? What happened?
Yeah, I was dating boys, but nothing much happened. But I think that it was just going through those kind of adolescence, naive stage of dating boys, and curious about dating. But I grew up in as a really, really disciplined teenager. I remember just my ideal date during that time was to get my boyfriend to come together to study together. So I would be really, really harsh on my date, my boyfriend, that if they are just fooling around, they just want to hang out more. No, we sit down and we go through our homework and we study for tests and exams, and that is how we dated.
Yeah,
And
so Ealing's not going, let's go to the movies or let's sneak cigarettes behind the school shed. You're like, let's do some calculus.
yes,
Let's
let's
read this
tell our
classic or whatever. Like you were very studious. Is that because you knew you wanted to be an academic or is that you by nature?
No, I think by nature I was really disciplined in getting. I enjoy. Okay, this is quite embarrassing to admit, but I really enjoy working through all the homework, and I we call them assessment books in Singapore, where you buy extra coaching supplementary materials. I don't know what you call it here, but I would always, pester my mom to go to the bookshop and get those books. So on top of the regular homework that we get from schools, I will buy more,
You
and
did your
sometimes
own.
I will buy the same copy twice. Like when I finish all the exercises, I will buy another copy of the same and then go through it again. And now
Oh,
when
wow.
I visit these bookshops in Singapore during my trip home, I will visit these bookshops and I'll touch the pages of these books, and my heart will be filled with so much
You loved it.
nostalgia. Yeah, I know.
I
So
don't think that's embarrassing at all. I mean, I think maybe that's because I was similar, maybe not to that degree, but I absolutely loved school. It's probably the one place where I felt really validated. And so, yeah, I will, I'm happy to admit from this age that I also enjoyed homework and I was a book nerd and the satisfaction I got from doing well in some subjects was, you know, it was very affirming. And it did actually mean I think then if you are struggling in other areas, whether it's family, dating, friends, whatever it is, it's a crutch, right? It's a safe space. So I don't think that's embarrassing. I think it's adorable, and goodness knows it's done, it's served you well. So move me to, if you don't mind, and you share as much or as little as you want, when do you start thinking maybe I would like to kiss a girl or a variation on that?
That only happened really late in life. So I've always felt that that wasn't it never crossed my mind. It was never in my imagination because growing up in such a heteronormative environment means that you don't have role models or imagination. Bear in mind that in Singapore, you don't even get to watch queer shows, movies. All these are completely censored and banned. And the portrayal of LGBTQI people is often it is only allowed if it's a negative
If
portrayal.
it's negative. So if it's like a prison setting or they're a criminal
Yes,
or
or
whatever,
somebody who has a mental health condition, someone who's an outcast. So and that is written into the code, into policy. So you don't have any role model imagination to think about, moving different directions. So it has never crossed my mind. I've always thought that I will only date boys and end up getting married and that's it. So my queer relationship really only started when I was already working, and that was my first proper official relationship was with my current partner, and we've been together for close to 18 years.
18
It's
years.
the longest relationship I've ever been, and I mean, obviously, it is working.
Yes. Well, how old are you now, Eileen, if you don't mind me asking?
am 48.
48. So this relationship starts when you're 30
Yeah.
and it's still going, which is amazing. Bravo. And I have met your lovely partner. And how do you identify? Do you identify as lesbian, queer, something else?
I teach a lot about identity representation and politics in class, and I have a lot to say about their development basic as well. So I'm not really comfortable with labels, and but if I have to answer that question, I would say that I'm queer because of the whole the whole concept, the conceptualization of queer, meaning that you don't, you are constantly interrogating normative structures of queer in that sense. And
Oh, Ailing, you know this is why I love you. This is exactly why we bonded that night, because I've had this discussion so many times, and I don't mean this in a snobby way, but there's so few people that understand what I mean when I say queer in the full sense of it. They might understand, oh, it's an I think in the ether now, it's a way of kind of people going, oh, she doesn't want to pick a team. Or she doesn't want to say what she, whereas for me, and this is like many decades long, it is exactly what you said. It is about a continual questioning of structures, labels, systems, culture, every, like it's so much more loaded than just kind of going, oh, I don't want to pick a team. Like I picked a team, it's the queer team. All right. So do you mind? And again, I'm very conscious that this is a really loaded question. So you, as I say with all my guests that I ask this of, who've been in long-term relationships, feel free to not answer it. Does being in a long-term committed relationship suit you? Like, what do you think about the model of that kind of relationship?
I think that in the true essence of queering lives and structures, there's no one fixed ideal model. So I won't be advocating for any particular model, and I won't be advocating for the model I'm in as well. I really think that it depends a lot on a few things, like largely on luck, to be honest. How the stars align in the universe for you, and I think that I'm lucky to be in this committed relationship now because it works as long as it has been, right? At any time it didn't work in the past, we could have parted, and there were many challenges. There were many times that we could have gone our separate ways because as migrants, migration, is such a great stressor. It could break relationships easily. And I have interviewed many international migrants who have lost their marriages because of migration. So I think that there's no fixed model that is ideal. I think that what has put us has really helped us stay together on the same course is really working out a lot of teething problems. Working out a certain kind of rhythm that makes sense both of us, and it's not even fixed because we change, our bodies change. We are going through perimenopause symptoms, our hormones are changing, our life causes are changing, and there are plenty of life events, and at our stage we are dealing with deaths, departures of loved ones, and that could break us easily and change us and change our partnership totally. So there are
Yiling, I think this is critical, actually. I reckon this is the key where, I mean, there's two things. I think I've said this before, but I think it's important to say it repeatedly. Because a relationship ends doesn't mean it's a failure, right? So if you're, and I'm not suggesting for a second that this will happen, but if your relationship with Sean ended tomorrow, it would still have been an amazing relationship. And we need to kind of query that script that if something ends, it was a failure. But the other thing I notice in successful, happy, functional long-term relationships is the key seems to be the ability to change with each other. So if there is migration, death, birth, illness, job changes, hormonal change, all the things that life is going to throw at all of us at some point, are you able to adapt with each other and grow with each other? The ones, even the ones that stay together that don't do that, I look at those and I think this is dysfunctional. You might still be together, but you're dysfunctional. And in other cases, it will end.
And it's a daily work, it's not, today we could have a good day and tomorrow who knows. And especially when there's so many things going on in our lives individually, when we come together and living in close proximity and we are in a one room flat, for God's sake.
Oh, you're in a
Horrible
one
time,
bedroom
really.
flat in Sydney. My God.
I
Now
know.
tell me, before I move you on, I'd like to know, what do you think is the most challenging part of a long-term relationship? And then what do you think is the best part of it in what whichever order you want to address those?
Well, the most challenging part is working out each other's rhythm of life. I think that, being in sync, because it's almost like having a really, really intimate roommate and family members. And families fight all the time, right? So we don't, I mean, it's really expected that we'll be fighting. But how do you have some form of reconciliation or communication where you can reach a certain rapport where both your rhythms are in sync? That takes so much work, and it's not easy. And that is challenging, and that is part of doing that work in a long-term committed relationship. But why do we stay in it? It's not because we are forced to, especially in a queer relationship. But why do I stay in it? Because there are other great parts, right? The great parts is that I found a soulmate, I found a partner in life. Especially there are so many things that in our life that we overlap, not just histories, but in our work, we are the best, teammates. We work together even before we came here to Australia. And then coming to Australia, we did our PhD together, we researched together, we published together, we are co-workers. So, and we are in the same discipline. We get each other political positions, philosophies, and advocacy. I think that really glue us. If we one is super conservative or right, and the other one is at the other end, it will clash for sure. But thankfully, we have developed same kind of politics towards different aspect of our lives, and I think that kind of make us be in sync, and that's the best part where you feel that I don't even need to unpack, and the other
Yes,
person get it,
the shorthand, right? So you've got shared values, you've got some shared interests at least. You obviously like each other's company if you're able to live in a one bedroom flat, plus you're able to work together and travel together. You do have My read, having spent a little bit of time with both of you, you've got different personalities, but they're complementary. And that idea, I think that's a really interesting idea going back to the challenge of rhythm, right? So if you're, and this is going to happen in any long-term partnership, like if you and I are in a relationship, I might be in a period of life where I'm like, go, 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 ambition. That could be work ambition, it could be other ambitions, and you might be in a, well, I'm just seeing how life goes and I'm, moving through it. Can you sit with those changes in rhythm with each other? Can you accommodate those? Can you even recognize that that's happening and that that's the challenge? I think that's a really fascinating way to frame it because we do go through periods of different rhythm depending on age, circumstances, age of kids, age of parents, age of, a whole range of things. Can you accommodate those changes in rhythm?
And can you also sit with the discomfort that sometimes you
Yes.
can't? And it's not
Yes.
perfection you're after. It's not like we need to be this perfect couple or this perfect soulmates that we always get each other or we are always in. Sometimes we're just not, you know.
And sometimes you're just going to give me the shits, right? So if my rhythm is like go, go, go at the moment, and yours is, you know what, I'm taking some me time and I'm going to sleep in, that is going to give me the shits. Can I sit with that? Can you sit with that when that reverses and changes? Or, yeah, can I be uncomfortable? If you can't be uncomfortable, I just don't think you can be in a relationship.
It's true because on many days it is uncomfortable. It's
Yeah.
uncomfortable when life just affects you differently.
Yeah.
And even though both of us are from the same nationality, culture, language, and academic training background, still times that we are just not in sync, especially when sickness come in the way when I've been struggling with chronic mental health condition for a long, long time, and it has not been easy for her to be my caregiver. And I think now she's struggling on her own as well. So we are taking turns to be each other's caregiver. And but there are days that both of us were sick, and who's going to care for us? And you
Yes.
become each other's punching bag, and you can't help it. But then at the end of the day, what we always do is that we try to reconcile very quickly within a couple of hours because there's just no point because we are also acutely aware of our mortality that life can be really short and people
Life's too short.
go very quickly and we don't want. That the last word to each other, if one person were to go, the last word to each other is an angry word. So we try to give each other space to cool down and within a couple of hours try to reconcile and work out something and not let it simmer for too long because it's just no.
And do you, and I'm absolutely respect your boundary on this if you don't want to, but since you've raised it, do you mind talking about the mental health condition you raised?
I've been diagnosed with complex PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. I have been struggling with chronic depression, chronic anxiety disorder, suicide ideation for a long time. I'm also struggling with fibromyalgia. So this has been something that's been ongoing for a while. My mental health has always been poor since I was a child, as young as like 6 or 7, I was already seeing a child psychiatrist. But it just got worse because your brain continues to degenerate, continues to age. And then with so many other traumatic life events like divorce, migration, racism, it just, weaken your brain to the
Compounds.
and then
And do you,
your brain is damaged.
so that has been part of your relationship with Shauna from the beginning?
From the beginning, I think that it has been bad, but then I think it just got worse over time as I age.
And do you mind if I ask, because I think this is a really common situation that we all experience, but also that a lot of our callers are dealing with. How do you manage the dynamic between you so that it's not always carer and cared for? Like, are you conscious of that dynamic? And what do you two put in place? I mean, I'm not trying to be superficial about it, but to keep it romantic, to keep it a romantic relationship rather than one taking care of the other.
We are not romantic.
You're not romantic.
Yeah, we are not, because I think that both of us find it really hard to be romantic, because we are both critics of romance and love, modern
Yeah.
love and intimacy, and we are acutely aware of how it is all tied to capitalism and
Yeah.
consumerism. So I wouldn't say that we don't find joy or find fun things to do. That's not true either. What would be a good time together is a stroll along the beach, just
Yeah.
talk to each other, walking, in the neighborhood. We love walks, and I think those things are important. It helps with my mental health condition as well. When she witnessed or when she observed that I'm sinking, she would draw me out and get me out of the house, and we'll go
Go
for
for
a
a
walk
walk.
in the
Yeah.
local park or go to the beach and just talk it out. And we do a lot of processing and communication during the walks, and that has been quite life-saving. It's also a change of environment that helps to just reset my brain. I think that has been really helpful. We enjoy doing things together. We enjoy cooking together. My idea of romance, if we have to use that word, is that I wake up in the morning and she'll cook me breakfast every day faithfully. So I will go to the dining table and pretend that I'm a customer in a cafe. So I stop cafes because she provides that cafe experience for me at home. I'll sit there with a book. I wouldn't move at all. So she will put the table mats. She will cook different kind
Beautiful.
of breakfast every day, and
Yeah.
it's cafe standard. And then she'll bring me the cutlery as well and coffee, and I'll just sit there and enjoy my breakfast. And
That's beautiful.
that is my idea of love and intimacy,
Oh,
and
Eileen, there's be
so
people listening, me
important.
included. Like, I think it may be a academic slash semantic kind of difference. Like, to me, that is romance. I'm not talking about buying roses, like going for a walk on the beach, or someone, recognizing that you're spiraling and saying, come on, let's go for a walk together. Cooking, people say, oh, she brought me a coffee every morning, or he went and got my favorite bagel every day, or whatever it is. Like, to me, that's romance. I mean, that kind of connection, that is kind of different to a friendship, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, and I think that she knows how to get me out of certain difficult moments. Like in the morning, it's always difficult for me because of brain fogs, and so a good, solid, amazing
Proper
breakfast.
brekkie.
Yeah, and the breakfast could be it's always so nicely presented with like pan-seared enoki or shiitake mushroom sitting on the bed of smashed avocado with a poached egg in,
Oh.
and kimchi as well to give you the probiotics. And so all kinds of every day is different, and
Now
Sunday
you're showing off, Aileen.
pancakes.
Come on, now you're showing off. Oh my Lord. If someone would cook me that kind of breakfast every morning, I'd be bloody romantic, let me tell you that much. You had me at kimchi, you know what I'm saying? And placemats.
Yeah,
How
placement
gorgeous.
cutlery. I wouldn't even bring my own cutlery, but I love pancake sundaes. Sunday,
Yeah,
it's always
gorgeous.
pancake, so it's lovely.
It's
Yeah.
those things, isn't it? It's that little things. They're not little things. They're actually the substance. It's that kind of moments of connection. And it might, for me, that'll be something like holding hands. Like, I'm really tactile and I need that kind of affection. And if I don't have that kind of affection, I really notice it and I really miss it. It's not about grand gestures. It's that kind of touch my arm as I walk past, stroke my hair. Like, whatever it is. Now, we have a segment, as you know, called Armchair Expert, where I put a meme to you. Now, I did not know that you had complex PTSD, but I think this is even more pertinent. It is from Tiny Buddha on Instagram, and the meme is, you cannot heal in the same environment that made you sick. What do you think about that?
Well, it really resonated with me a lot. And It resonated with me because I think that I took a lot of courage to leave an environment that was acutely racist. I was completely broken, and just shattered into pieces. And it came to a point of despondence and hopelessness that I attempted suicide.
Oh,
Yeah,
Amy.
and I just didn't know how to find hope. I really didn't know how to. It wasn't a deliberate move to be, some people like to say that, oh, you are selfish, you didn't think about the people that you're leaving behind. But it came to a point where I think that the worst form of humanity is where you reach a point where you can't find hope. And I couldn't find hope. I just couldn't find hope
And
in
Eileen,
those
was this a
possibilities.
workplace or a
It
different sort of
was a
environment? A
workplace.
workplace.
So,
This is critical, right? So this is the reason, and as I said, I didn't know that you had CPTSD before I put this in. But the reason I put it in is because I know you're an academic. And one of the things that drives me absolutely round the bend is when we talk about, like, when we individualize social and structural problems. So the example I always give is, you take a little queer kid in a high school that's homophobic, where he's getting bullied, where no one's supporting him. He might be getting that at home. And then we go, oh, he's not well. He needs a psychiatrist. Like that environment, there is no way on earth anyone could withstand that and not feel sick in the sense that we understand illness. He's not broken. The environment's broken.
Exactly. And yeah, it's hard, right, when you protest or you make a complaint, and then the response that you get is that you're either overthinking it, or that you're too sensitive, or that you need support. So we're going to send you for employment assistance scheme. Comes with free counseling. It's like,
Yes.
my God, I don't think I was even more insulted than that when
Do
that
some yoga, Eiling. Do some yoga, right?
or just take it easy, like
Take it
don't
in, like have a
yeah.
bath. One of my, I don't think I've told you this story before, but long story short, I rang a particular like carer organization because I have two kids with disabilities. And I was at the absolute end of my tether, and I'd been told to ring this place and they could offer help. You go through this odious and onerous criteria. It took like 40 minutes to assess your eligibility, all of this stuff. And right at the end, the woman said to me, "So, what would you like? Like, how could we help you?" And I said, "You know what? I would really like someone to come and clean the gutters. It's just one of those jobs. I just can't get to it. I don't want to get up on the ladder. I can't leave the kids in the house, et cetera, et cetera." And I swear to you, Eileen, she said to me, "Look, we can't do that, but I do have vouchers for Zoom yoga." And I thought, if ever there was an anecdote to show the shit show and the absolute misunderstanding and misapplication of wellness to structural and social problems, you're talking to an isolated single mother carer asking you for help. You've told me you can help me. I've told you this is exactly what I need. I've done all the thinking. And you say, do some fucking yoga. Oh, can you imagine?
it's horrifying to just hear this. Yeah,
Isn't
but it
it?
happens all the time about how social problems are individualized.
Individualized, yeah.
The person who complains about the problem becomes the problem, right? That
Yes.
the
Yes.
person becomes the problem, the troublemaker that needs to be diagnosed, that needs to be fixed, that
Yes.
needs to, be silenced and
Pathologized.
yeah.
Absolutely pathologized. And in the context of this podcast, I see this, and not universally, but I see this with couples counseling as well, where you can see a relationship is fundamentally done. It doesn't even have to be toxic, but it may indeed be toxic and it may even be abusive. But either way, it is done. If you looked at it from any outside perspective, any objectivity, you'd say this has run its course. And what is our solution as a society? You need couples counseling. And indeed, there are couples counselors, I've seen this in to some degree, I've experienced it, who are so invested in the model of couples staying together that regardless of what they see, they advocate for that. And I stress again, that's not all. There's some fantastic couples counselors, but this idea that you can be in a bad relationship and be healthy individually is a nonsense. You're not going to heal. It doesn't matter how much yoga, how much therapy, how much kale you eat. If the relationship's bad, you're going to feel bad.
And also, if they are dealing with broader structures of inequality, that could be if a migrant
Oh.
that come together and they are dealing with migration issues, say for example visa, right? Or that their family members are still stuck in the war-torn countries, or they're coming together and there's a lot of stress, a lot of cracks because of employment issues, or they're facing racism in their own workplace or in their everyday life, and that's why the relationship is cracking up. Going to couple counseling is not going to make
Fix
these
that.
problems go
That's right.
away. They will just only be made to feel that I'm not good enough, I'm
Yeah.
not good. I need to
Yeah.
work hard. I need to be a better person, a
You're
better
not
partner.
trying hard enough
Yeah.
is the message, rather than going, you are so burdened. It's like that idea of, new mothers in particular. I think this happens too, but it could. There's a whole range of groups. That's just my own experience. I remember being a new mum and all that stuff of, oh, just don't worry about doing the washing. You're like, oh, okay. So now I'm sleep deprived and living in a shithole. No, what we need to do is actually wrap our arms around new mothers and help them rather than tell them, just let that go. And there's so many other issues to which this applies. I noticed when I was in the last few years, doing online dating, lots of queer dating, the amount of family violence that the women that I was going on date or the people that I was going on dates with had experienced. And I know they haven't told people. I know that there is overlays of racism and homophobia and misogyny and all the things tied up in that. And then to say to that woman, oh, you need to do some meditation. I mean, I'm preaching to the converted. So we have to heal the environment, right? Or we have to leave the environment.
Yeah, we have to. I think that after leaving the environment, it's also really good to take a good look at the environment, like what is broken there? What is the
Yes.
environment that is causing your pain and causing the issues, the pain of other people? And as an academic who has done, who is always looking at different kind of structural problems, I think that to take many step back is to really question some of these institutions that have been imposed on us, the institution of marriage, the institution of family, right? And we are being sold a myth, a promise that that doesn't deliver all the time. In fact, it comes with a lot of impositions, a lot of stress, and we are supposed to believe that every time you enter into a marriage or every time you have a family, it is a site of happiness.
Yes.
But it is not necessarily so. And the institutions were put in place for very clear, purposes, starting from colonialism to capitalism and now neoliberalism. I mean, we can't not see that. But then, but the whole idea of being in this system is that we are already blinded. We are not conscious of that, right? And we
Oh, for
think we just
sure.
have to fix our individual sites and we all be good. But
Yeah.
these sites are being created to sell a promise that not always going to deliver, and there's too much expectations placed on that,
I'll
and
give
people
you
being
Ely.
trapped. That's the worst part, right? Being trapped
Yeah.
that we need to make it work in order for us to be happy. We need to get onto that red carpet in order that you will give us happiness. I think that's the trap that we are now all stuck in.
Yes, and which we just, despite all of the various modes of information that we have now, we seem to still be stuck in. So I'll give you a concrete example. We had a letter a couple of episodes ago from a guy who essentially said, look, I'm in my mid-50s. I keep starting relationships. A little while into the relationship, I get bored and I'm not interested in anymore. And he was really ashamed of that. And long story short, my view is one of two things is going on. Either he needs to go into therapy to look at whether or not there's something that's blocking him getting what he wants, like is it self-sabotage? But I think the more likely answer is he's not built for monogamy. And some people simply aren't. They are not built for long-term monogamous commitments. And that doesn't make you a broken person. We don't need to pathologize that. If we are ripping up the script, in my language, of, colonialism, patriarchy, capitalism, all the things that lead to 2.2 kids in the suburbs and a mum and dad, if we are actually going to rip that up, then there's nothing wrong with this guy. He needs to be honest with the people that he's dating, but he's not a broken person to not be able to fit the model that he didn't choose.
Yeah, and also the question is that people can change, and like people can have different preferences about lives, or they are in a different crossroad of their lives, and that's perfectly fine. And it doesn't mean that that we have to stick to a fixed mold in order to be whole, to be happy, and that we shouldn't be made to feel that there's something wrong with us, or that we should be punished. And that's just the whole queering part is about, right? That we are queer because we believe that that humanity is complex. There's multitude of humanity, and it is beautiful that way, and we should just celebrate it. And why is it that we are stuck in the current normative structures? It's not. It's and I always tell students that it's not natural, and it's not accidental. It is not as natural as you see how the sun rises in the morning. But they are all constructed for very particular political, economic agendas. And they may change in their forms, but the principles of capital accumulation, capital hoarding is still the same. And it's often tied to race as well. So it's these things that I think that if we are able to kind of gain certain understanding, we might feel ourselves a little bit more conscious of the entrapment that comes within.
Yes, and I think once you start questioning those things, and I've had the privilege of being able to do that through education and, friends and work, but everyone has that opportunity to a greater or lesser degree. Just start questioning things. Where did that idea come from? Where did it come from? Whose script is that? Who does it serve? Does it match reality? I mean, that idea of we've just been through, Christmas and New Year in Australia. The idea of the happy family sitting around the Christmas tree, we all know that that doesn't apply to probably most of the people we know. And yet it's still ingrained, even for those of us who are critical. So it's an ongoing work, but I think it's a really valuable work because I hate, the term gaslighting is overused, but I think there is a cultural gaslighting going on with this stuff. If you follow the rules, you'll be happy, despite all the fucking evidence of the misery that those rules have caused many, many people. Just follow the toe the line, toe the line. It's we're too old for that shit, Ealing.
And the problem is also that the systems do encourage it, because
Of course they do.
if everything is put in policy and in incentives, right? For example, throwing baby bonus or tax benefits for heteronormative early married couples. The truth is that there is reward. There are rewards that will
Of
make it happen
course.
because it is a lot easier. So it is also not true that there's no happiness. In fact, it is the society is built to give you the happiness,
Yes, true.
but then it can also come with a lot of unhappiness, because then you feel that you need to then fulfill certain expectations. And I've seen a lot in my research, respondents that I've interviewed, how they try so hard to get back to the red carpet, how they try so hard to get married again despite having a few failed marriages, even in their 60s and 70s. And these are income men who don't have the capacity to raise a family or to keep the family together, but they still think that if only I get married again, I will be a man again. My masculinity will be rescued. I will be a man again. But in the end, it hurts them as well, really, because they find themselves so depleted. They have no money, and everything just backfires. So it hurt us all. right?
Yeah, and they feel like they're getting everything wrong. I know this is a weird analogy, but I think it holds. It is like the idea that so many women are sold, and I think increasingly all the genders, once you lose weight, you will feel so and so. Once you look a certain way, once you're a certain size, once you're a certain number on the scales, then everything, you will be more successful at work and you will have more relationships and people will like you more. Now, that's not to deny the cultural capital that comes from being slim, because that's real. But none of those things are true, right? Your shit follows you, whether you're size 10 or size 30. And same with that, there'll be some benefits. You'll be sitting at the barbecue and you'll be, I'm a husband. And people go, okay, I get that. But you still got to go home and be the husband. All right. Can I give you a listener letter, Eileen?
Sure.
Okay. So I'm actually combining a few different listener questions that I've had recently around, I don't know if you've listened to these episodes, but we talk about needing a coven. Right. So needing, and it's a reclaiming of the whole idea of a bunch of witches, but the idea is needing a friendship circle that might be a small friendship circle, but some kind of support system, particularly when you're older, and particularly for a lot of listeners who might have experienced the end of a long-term relationship or other kinds of loss. And I think it's particularly pertinent to ask you this question because you have had to migrate. And you have had to land in a new city, presumably where you knew very few people. How do you build new friendships at our age?
It's so hard.
It is hard, isn't it? It's not as easy as when you're
It's
20.
hard. It is very hard. It's hard when you have social anxiety. It's
Yeah.
hard when you are a migrant, you know. It's hard, especially when you are older as well. And you know, you are busy and life gets in the way and things like that. It is getting harder and harder. And I have to admit that finding good friends or you know intimate friendships in Sydney has not been easy. It is really hard and I think that I'm not the only one who has said this. I've heard other friends who are non white migrants here that it's really hard to penetrate into certain circles, social circles of you know white Australian friends and colleagues, to be honest. But I think we are lucky that we managed to find our own community of queer friends and as well as especially queer migrants, people of color. I think that really helps. It but it's not it's it has not been consistent because people move away. People come, people move away. We had friends when we were doing our PhD, and then you know, after PhD, everybody just kind of get dispersed to different parts of the world. And then when you're working, you do you know you find friends among your colleagues, but then there's also that sensitivity about you know building friendships at the workplace and then it's a lot of talk shop you know kind of situations, so, which is not always pleasant. Sometimes it just make you feel, oh, when can I get out of the work context?
Well, and then presumably, I mean, in the work context as well, there can be privacy issues, right? You might want to go to certain events, for example, that aren't like work appropriate that you do in your personal life. And how much do you reveal? How much is safe to reveal, in a work context? Do you, going back to you saying social anxiety, because I think that's something that I hear, that's one of the few anxieties I don't understand because I have other kinds of anxiety, but social anxiety is not one of them. But I know a lot of our listeners have social anxiety. Do you have social anxiety?
Very bad social anxiety.
Isn't this, can I just say this is, I don't know whether you find this interesting, but I do. I did not pick up on that at all in my interactions with you. Like you seem very like confident socially, and we chatted very easily, and we both seem to have a good time, and we've stayed in touch. So do you think you just cover it well, or have I just like missed something?
Well, social anxiety works differently for different people. It
Yeah.
is a really broad term, a very generic term. So you it could manifest very differently for different people. My symptoms of social anxiety comes in very different ways. Like, for example, before a social gathering, I'll be really, really nervous. My hands will be clammy.
Yep.
And I will there'll be a lot of thoughts of how I could run away from that situation. Like maybe I'm sick or
Yes.
something, like I have a
Yes.
stomach ache or what. And I will have to run the toilets.
Yeah. So you
It's
want to
also
avoid.
physical. It's also physical, right?
Yeah, it
So you have
is. Yeah.
physical manifestation. And then and there will be situations that there'll be certain times that I will not go. Like and if I know that I will my social anxiety can be so bad that I will deliberately avoid certain situations where if I have to attend, say, a conference, if I have to attend a large event where there are breakout groups or tea. Oh, that's like my ultimate like the ultimate most anxiety-inducing thing for me to have that small talks over tea and also being really worried about whether people will talk to me and feel really vulnerable and exposed. And there were many times growing up, even in my young adult life and even before coming here, that I would during the tea break I would hide in the toilet.
Oh, darling.
Yeah, so it's that bad. Yeah, so my
Yeah.
social anxiety is
Oh,
that bad.
no, I
So I will
understand. So,
literally walk out of the venue and
yeah.
rather pay for my tea or my lunch
Yeah.
instead of doing free lunch and free tea break at the
Yeah.
conference.
And feeling awkward. So,
Yes.
we have just going back to the physical symptoms, and I mean, this is gross, but it's also real. Like in comedy land, we have this thing we say you have festival ass, right? Which basically means that during comedy festival or during periods of intense performing, everyone gets digestive issues. Everyone gets like either diarrhea, constipation, or both. Some people, even really experienced people, throw up before a show. I've certainly, we joke about it, but it's that dark humor stuff that we talked about at the start. I've been on my way to shows and literally thought to myself, if I have a car accident, can I cancel? Not that, not like I want to die, but where I've got like a plausible excuse,
Yeah, I'm similar.
and that will be, that's not me every time I perform, that's specific events, right, where I don't feel comfortable or safe, but I sort of have to do them. You have that level of anxiety sometimes, literally going into like a conference or into, I don't know, a dinner party or.
Yeah, it's usually social situations that I cannot control. So I have no problem teaching, going to a big lecture theater with like 500 students or performing or anything like that. When I know there's a fixed role and I know
Yes,
what I need to do,
yes,
but it is
yes.
uncontrolled social situations
Oh,
that
Edeline, you should be a
me
comedian.
out.
This is exactly why I picked you out of that lineup. I've only just realized you have a comedian's temperament. Like, I am very rare in comedy land to not have social anxiety. Almost every comedian I know is very comfortable on stage, literally talking to hundreds, even thousands of people, because they are in control of the situation to a certain degree. You get them doing small talk, you get them signing autographs or chatting to the audience, they completely crumble. It's a very, very different thing. And it seems like the one on stage is harder, but it's not if you have that temperament. Like, actually, the small talk's harder.
It's harder because also the distance, right?
Yeah,
The
that's right.
proximity to another person and having to think about what to say. And another part of the social anxiety is rumination after that.
Okay.
Ruminating till, oh God, it was it the intrusive thoughts
Thoughts.
couldn't shake off for days. Like, how did I say
Wow.
something stupid? Or did I say something to offend anyone? Should I be apologizing? It's endless. And you wish sometimes you could just open your brain and dig all these things out, but you can't.
You
So
can't.
that is part of the social
That's not
anxiety.
how it works. Can I ask you? So obviously we've hung out a couple of times, including a dinner and chatting, after the event and interacting. Just to give me context, do you then, like, you and I have dinner, do you then go home after going, oh, I shouldn't have said this to Nellie? Why did I say this? Will she think this? Is that how it works?
Remember that I spilled the glass of wine?
Oh, yes.
Did
Oh, Eileen,
yes.
no.
Until today,
Oh,
I'm
darling.
still wishing that I didn't do that, and I wish that I think
Last week's.
that I caught your expression. I think that I don't think that you were conscious of it, but it was a bit of a surprise and taken aback. I remember the expression till today, and I thought that, oh shit, I have offended Nelly,
Oh,
and I
not at all.
was Fei who I know I stained her dress, her clothes. I felt screwed.
Oh.
Although both of you were so gracious and so generous, but it will never be. Social anxiety is never about how
No.
people are, right? It's about
No.
how you think they are, or
Yeah.
how you think that you have let people down, right?
Yeah.
That is the problem. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, no. I mean, I understand the, and I don't mean this in the pejorative, I mean it literally. I understand the irrationality of anxiety because I have that in other areas. I mean, let me reassure you 100%, I haven't thought about it again until you, and this is the great tragedy of anxiety, right? Where you're sitting there kind of ruminating. In my case, it might be that I don't know, I got a joke wrong, or I didn't handle a heckler how I wanted to, or whatever it is. No one else is thinking about it. But for me, anxiety makes it front and center. You know, and yeah, I understand that. So in terms of for people listening who have social anxiety, because I'm really aware when I'm asked this question, I know that I find that so easy. I am really blessed in that sense. I walk into a room full of strangers and I do not feel anxious at all. So I would actually rather hear from you, talking to listeners directly who have social anxiety. What advice would you give them about making friendships?
I think well, for me, what works is that I'm better and more comfortable with one-on-one
Yes.
rather than in groups, in
So
groups of
coffees, having a coffee with someone or whatever, a
having a
meal.
meal, having a
Yeah.
walk together,
Yeah.
it makes a lot of difference. Getting to having that curiosity in someone's life and genuinely being interested in that person's life, I think that really works for me. And so if I do really have to attend those tea breaks and lunch break, I seek out people who are on their own because I
Yes.
know right. And just want to connect to another human being and be less concerned about who is in the room and you know less concerned about you know networking with the right people, but just being kind to myself and kind to the other person by just having that connection, that moment of connection. And I think that those are the things that are valuable to me.
Can I give you a perspective of an extrovert? If, because I've been in that situation many times. If you approached me, and obviously I emcee a lot of conferences and things like that, if you approached me and said, I'm feeling anxious and I'm here by myself, you'd be under my wing for the rest of that conference, right? There's going to be extroverts at that, or people who are socially confident, whatever terminology you want to use. If you put it out there, I promise you, you will find someone who'll go, come with me, Eileen, or the listeners. And once it's spelled out, like an extrovert like me loves a job. We love a task, right? So if you say, let's, you know, can you literally take me under your wing? I'll be like, let's do it.
Can I bring you to every conference I have to attend?
Yes, you can. Let's do that. Let's work up a system. I'll MC it. I'll hold your hand during the lunch break. I'll bring people over. I'll be your wingman. No problem. I want you to tell me, like, if you could think of the hottest celebrity, like someone that at least some of the listeners would have heard of, if you could go on a date, I mean, you're not dating, but let's imagine you are. If you could go on a date with someone, give me your, like, hot and tot hottie.
I actually don't think that I want to go on a date with a celebrity.
Yeah.
I find that question hard to answer because I'm actually not keen to date a celebrity or even go out with a celebrity.
Yeah.
Reason because I think that I like to keep the illusion. the fantasy, you know, just
Yes.
seeing them on screen and pretending that they're these perfect human beings.
Yeah.
And I don't want them to talk to me to spoil that illusion.
Yes, like you
Really.
shouldn't meet your heroes. I get it.
And I think that sometimes you watch some of them do interviews, you're like, oh my God, what are
I
you talking
know.
about?
Why?
Yeah. So I have no interest in wanting to go on a date with a celebrity, let alone the hottest celebrity, because I think that I don't want to know their flaws.
Yeah.
And I don't want them to let me down so that I can continue to watch their shows.
So, Aileen, you're basically saying to me that's a stupid question, Nellie, and I accept that. All right. So, what I want you to do is imagine someone hot. It doesn't have to be a celebrity. Just imagine them in your head. You're on a date with them. I'm referring to the TikTok trend, like they're a 10 butt. So, the date's going really well. They're so hot. Everything's going great. And then they do something where you think, I'm out of here. What would that something be?
I'm hyperallergic and hypersensitive to any thoughts or opinions that are remotely or slightly racist, sexist, misogynist, and queerphobic. So if anyone, no matter how good looking you are and how perfect your body is, and if you just stray slightly there, that's it for me.
Yeah.
Really, everything will shut down. It'll be a physiological reaction. I
Yes.
won't be able to swallow my food. I'll feel like I need to run away. And yeah, I think, well, it would just trigger my PTSD, to be honest. So I
Yeah.
think that would be like, straightforward for me to
Yeah.
just end the evening early and move on and let them be who they are. So, and it's not difficult to spot like some of the things that's being said, the assumptions that are being made about people. Yeah, it will be just so easy to pick it up.
Yeah, so that would be your deal breaker, and I think that's a common deal breaker because there's also a point at which you think, well, I can't, no matter how hot you are, even in a one night stand, Eileen, you're going to talk at some point. So if you don't want to be stuck in a situation where you're on the receiving end of bigotry. Eileen, thank you so much for joining us on Dear Nelly. I would love you to come back if you'd like to come back when we don't have so many technical hitches and take some calls. And I thank you for your openness and your generosity. And I will see you at the next conference at the tea table.
Thank you.
Thank you, Eileen. Bye.
Bye.
Dear Nelly, I could use some advice, dear Nelly. Yes, some help would be nice, dear Nelly. I'm eager to hear your point of view, dear Nelly. There's a lot to explore, dear Nelly. When you're 40 or more, dear Nelly. So I'm hoping we can talk it through.
Hey, thanks so much for listening to Dear Nelly. Now, don't be shy. I would love to hear your questions and comments. To send me a recording or an email, go to nellythomas.com and follow the links. It's super easy, and you might hear me talk about your question in a future episode. Huge thanks to producer Sam Peterson from the Producer Boy Creative Production Team, and to producer Faye Younger, who, in addition to being an excellent human, is also a brilliant real estate buyer's advocate and can be found at youngerhill.com. Thanks to Acast and all the team. And lastly, to you. Without the listeners, I'm just a middle-aged mole talking shit to no one. Please rate, review, and consider subscribing for $5 a month for a bonus episode and to help me keep the lights on. And tell your bloody mates, would you? I'd really appreciate it. Love yous.